Hello, listeners. Jordan here. I just want to let you know that you can listen to Nighttime early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Include it with Prime.
Want visibly glowing skin in 14 days? With new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash, you can lather and glow. The 24-hour moisturizing body wash is infused with vitamin B3 complex and has notes of rose and cherry creme for a rich, indulgent experience. Treat your senses with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. Buy it today at major retailers.
Introducing the first-ever Mazda CX-70, our largest two-row SUV. Available as a mild hybrid inline six turbo or as a plug-in hybrid. Crafted to move every part of you.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Welcome back to an ongoing series exploring the life and the crime of Lindsay Suvanaroth, the young woman convicted of conspiracy to commit murder as a result of her role in the foiled Halifax Shopping Center Valentine's Day shooting plot. In the last entry in this series, Part 5, Unloading James and Lindsay's Arsenal, we were joined by firearms expert Trevor Furlott, who helped us understand the capabilities of the rifle and shotgun James Gamble had planned to contribute to this plot, and how the plotter's inexperience may have come into play had an anonymous tipster not changed the course of the story. In this episode, we'll review an altogether different aspect of Lindsay Suvanaroth's story. Rather than focusing on the specifics of the Valentine's Day shooting plot like we did in Part 5, we'll instead look at the subculture that both Lindsay and James were members of. An association that had served to initially bring them together, and then to provide them with some of the dark inspiration for their plot to shoot, kill, and die together in the Halifax Shopping Center's food court. Tonight, in this episode of Nighttime, we'll enter the strange world of Lindsay Suvanaroth and the Columbiners.
Another shout out about my Eric Harris pillow. Ooh, I love my Eric Harris pillow. Yay!
During our time with Lindsay, we were left with a lot of uncomfortable things to consider. And that's even if we exclude the mass shooting plot. Hearing her discuss her connections with Nazism was very upsetting to a large portion of the show's audience. My email inbox can prove that if anyone needs to see it. But at least to me, when I consider our current social climate, her ideological views don't seem as rare as I had always thought them to be. Turns out in 2019, racism, sadly, is alive and well. The thing that really surprised me, however, was her association with the subculture referred to as Columbiners. The world of the Columbiners was completely new to me, and Lindsay's story served as my introduction. Shortly after Lindsay's arrest, when the news of the foiled plot began spreading, the press quickly began to refer to Lindsay and James as being obsessed with the Columbine High School massacre. Initially, I had simply thought this was the press's way of saying it was some sort of copycat-type crime. But as I followed the developments in the case and further researched the players in this story, what I quickly learned is that there's in fact a large community of people from all over the world who use their intense interest in the Columbine massacre as a sort of twisted glue to hold their large social network together. Now, of course, I've seen many message boards and groups dedicated to the discussion of specific crimes or missing persons cases. But the Columbiners, they're different. This seems to be more like fandom or even hero worship than it was about curiosity or research. It's honestly unlike anything I've ever encountered and unlike anything I'd ever have expected. To anyone listening to this that is unfamiliar with the Columbiners, this episode will be full of surprises. And for those of you who are aware of them, you'll likely learn some new things about the history of this subculture and how various aspects of the Columbine attack influenced Lindsay and James and their plot to kill. In a few short moments, we'll get to a discussion I had with Rachel Monroe an American writer and investigative journalist who spent a tremendous amount of time researching the Columbiners and who recently completed work on a new book that will feature Lindsay Suvannaroth's story. But before we get to my talk with Rachel, I want to take some time to give a crash course on the Columbine school shooting and provide a bit of background on how that tragedy influenced Lindsay Suvannaroth and James Gamble.
Good evening, everyone. The reaction of so many people today was, oh no, not again. Another high school, Columbine High in Littleton, Colorado, this time on the edge of Denver. It has been a horror. The gunman, fellow students who rushed the school and opened fire for reasons we do not know yet, for reasons we may never know. Two of the young killers are dead. The sheriff says it looks like a suicide mission.
Eyewitnesses say the two gunmen wearing black trench coats and black masks came in shooting and began working their way through the school. Teachers raced ahead to classrooms, yelling for students to run. Someone pulled a fire alarm.
Started coming in the library and opening fire and shooting off bombs.
There was a guy at a table right next to us, next to me and her, and they just shot him and then walked away, and then he was just sitting there in a pool of blood.
For hours after the shooting began, police were picking their way through the building, looking for the suspects, students who were hiding or trapped, and more victims. What police and everyone else are looking for now is a reason for the violence that tore this quiet school and suburban neighborhood apart just weeks before graduation.
I think it's safe to assume anyone listening to this has at least a basic understanding and probably some unsettling memories of the Columbine High School massacre. But just in case you're unfamiliar, I'll give you enough information to provide the necessary context for the rest of the episode. Now, that news clip you just heard described some of the chaos that resulted from one of North America's, if not the world's, most well-known school shootings. It happened at Columbine High School, in a town with a population just under 25,000 in Colorado. On the morning of April 20th, 1999, two 12th grade students, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, armed a series of homemade explosives they placed in and around their high school. The first was placed in a greenbelt several kilometers away from the school. This was planned to go off first and distract emergency responders. The second were two duffel bags containing bombs made out of propane tanks. These were placed within the school's cafeteria and were timed to go off during the lunch hour rush. And the third bombs, they were built into Eric and Dylan's cars. These were timed to explode as emergency crews descended in response to the cafeteria bombs. As Eric and Dylan entered the school that morning, armed with knives, a variety of firearms, and backpacks filled with pipe bombs and ammunition, their plan was to open fire on those fleeing the chaos caused by the cafeteria bombs. Fortunately, as things turned out, the cafeteria bombs, which would have led to an unimaginable number of fatalities, had failed to detonate. However, that didn't stop Eric and Dylan from roaming the halls, taunting and shooting anyone who crossed their paths. In the end, after unleashing roughly 47 minutes of terror, Eric and Dylan would take their own lives in the school's library. Left in their wake, Columbine High School had lost 12 students and one member of faculty, with many others seriously injured. Now, the Columbine attack, it's gone on to change the conversation that surrounds social issues such as school shootings, gun control, and bullying. But it has also gone on to inspire an ever-growing list of copycats. Lindsay Suvannaroth and James Gamble perhaps are among the most devoted on that list. In fact, it would be difficult to understand the story of Lindsay, James, and the Valentine's Day shooting plot without at least a decent understanding of Eric Harris, Dylan Klebold, and the Columbine Massacre. Nearly every aspect of Lindsay and James' planning in some way took inspiration from or played homage to Eric and Dylan. When I initially reviewed the 1,200-page log of the Facebook conversations between Lindsay and James, one of the things that stood out to me was the near-constant references to Eric and Dylan, and the way in which these references evolved. It started out by Lindsay and James comparing themselves to this murderous couple they idolized. But as you heard Lindsay describe, it quickly got to the point that Lindsay and James believed that in some supernatural way, they had become Eric and Dylan. It's admittedly very strange and equally as difficult to put in my own words how this deepening obsession presented itself in the plotting of the Valentine's Day shooting. I think the best way I could explain this to you is to present three separate excerpts from Lindsay and James' Facebook conversation to provide examples of how these references to Columbine occurred. The first excerpt I'll share is from very early on in James and Lindsay's relationship. Only days after connecting, and still at a time prior to the birth of their mass shooting plot, the pair briefly discuss some of their friends and do so using the comparisons of Eric and Dylan before ultimately Lindsay and James choose their individual roles in their new relationship. But to provide some context to this piece, in the world of Columbine, Eric Harris is often said to be the more aggressive and bloodthirsty of the pair, with Dylan Klebold taking on more of a supporting role, motivated more so by his eventual suicide than the actual massacre.
How strong is it?
Depends on how much wine you add to it. By the way, I can't remember if you've seen photos of me in my black trench coat or not.
I think I have.
There's some on my Facebook page and others on my Tumblr. You really should get Skype, though.
I used to have it. I'm not a fan of phone calls or interactions where people can see me, hear my voice.
See, I was just thinking that if you had it, I could introduce you to some people. Like Sutcliffe Juggin from Tumblr. I know you follow her. She's been a friend of mine for several years now.
The name sounds familiar.
This is her, in case you've forgotten. Fun fact, she almost shares a birthday with Eric Harris. And she acts just like him sometimes, too. And her name happens to be Erica.
That's really cool, actually. It's hilarious that Dylan's birthday is on 9/11.
She's also the reason why I changed my Tumblr icon to Dylan, so I can be him while she's Eric. Even though I feel I have more in common with Eric.
I feel like I'm a combination of the two of them.
We all are in some way or another. Though I'd like to think of it in terms of the relationship dynamic between them. Like, I'm the Eric to some other people's Dylan, and the Dylan to some other people's Eric. If that makes sense.
Yeah, I get it. I don't really have that, unfortunately.
How come?
Not close enough with anybody.
Hell, neither am I really. Like, I never made any friends in college ever. All my friends are online, basically.
I only have one friend in real life. He isn't down for the whole mass murder thing. But he'd be Dylan, no doubt. He's taller than me and has long blonde hair.
And I could be your Eric. How's about that?
That'd be nice.
The next excerpt I'll share occurred weeks later. At this point, their planning is well underway, and Lindsay and James are beginning to make references to becoming Eric and Dylan rather than simply taking on the role. In this excerpt, they joke about meeting up with Eric and Dylan in hell and discuss what they may say to them.
My slave.
I am.
The one and only. Like I said, we're so, so lucky.
Think about the chain of events that led us here. It's incredible.
And how we took on the personalities of Eric and Dylan.
Exactly.
Which has been happening all throughout my life without me even realizing it.
It's crazy. I got into Columbine way back in 2007. If only I knew that I'd carry out something similar in a decade.
I wasn't even into Columbine until like these past few months. Though I had friends who were.
Did you know basic things about it, though? Like their names?
Yeah. I only started seriously researching it after when, for some reason, I felt the need to put a school shooting into my novel.
And we wouldn't be talking now if you didn't.
Indeed.
It's funny how things work out.
Whether it's fate or luck or coincidence, it's something.
It has to be. I never really believed in that stuff before. Maybe it's just an extraordinary coincidence.
Or it could have all been determined from the beginning.
That is also very possible. All the religious nut jobs will think we're possessed by Satan and that we'll be burning in hell.
If we were, at least we'd be able to hang out with Eric and Dylan.
Can you imagine? What's up, guys? We just beat your high score.
Hey, Eric, I was you for the past few months.
What if souls are real and we will end up wandering the earth for eternity? Death is so fucking fascinating.
The next and final excerpt I'll share has a much different tone, not at all playful like what you just heard. What may come as a surprise to people following this story is that Lindsay and James were incredibly supportive and caring, at least towards each other. James was very open about his depression and his struggle to delay suicide, and Lindsay always seemed willing to hear him out and provide a shoulder to cry on, so to speak. In this next piece, which occurred just weeks before Lindsay boarded the plane to Halifax, you'll hear James describing his longing for death, and you'll hear Lindsay attempting to comfort him, all in the context of Columbine.
I want to die already.
It'll be better when we die together.
I can imagine it. When everything is over, and we'll find some secluded spot in the mall to go to.
Comforting each other, knowing we'll be together in death.
Do you think you'll be crying? I'll hug you if you do.
I might be. We'll share one last kiss. It'll be beautiful.
We'll set my phone up in front of us. Say our final things, then shoot ourselves on camera. I wish I could be hugging you right now. I need it bad.
I'd hug you, and I'd hold you.
Thank you for not finding me weak, even though I cry constantly.
It's okay to cry.
Thank you.
I'm always here for you. It's what Eric would do for Dylan.
I wonder if they ever cried together. Or what their final moments were like.
I guess we'll find out.
Do you ever feel like after death, you'll get all the answers to all your questions you've ever had? It'd be nice.
Maybe.
I think I'll go to bed soon.
All right.
I'll message you when I wake up tomorrow.
Good boy.
Those three clips, as unsettling as they are, were shared simply to illustrate the extent that Eric Harris, Dylan Klebold, and the Columbine attack consumed the thoughts and planning of Lindsay and James. Had I not looked so closely into this particular story, I would think this obsession was simply a one-in-a-million type occurrence. But as I said earlier, Lindsay and James are not as unique as we may think. There are actually a lot of people who look to the Columbine shooters in a similar fashion. So now that we've discussed Columbine and how it's found its way into Lindsay and James's planning, we have the necessary context to zoom out and take a better look at this subculture that Lindsay and James were or are members of, the Columbiners. To assist in helping me unpack this topic, I've invited someone who knows as much, if not more, about the Columbiners and about the story of Lindsay Suvanaroth than anyone else. She's an American-based journalist who's wrote extensively about the Columbiners and has a book featuring the story of Lindsay Suvanaroth set to be released in the coming months. After a short break, we'll be joined by Rachel Monroe.
Want visibly glowing skin in 14 days? With new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash, you can lather and glow. The 24-hour moisturizing body wash is infused with vitamin B3 complex and has notes of rose and cherry creme for a rich, indulgent experience. Treat your senses with new Olay Indulgent Moisture Body Wash. Buy it today at major retailers.
Everyone's got a thirst, a drive to be the next big thing, to put the world on notice. If you answer when your thirst calls, Sprite's for you. Sprite's for the makers and creators, the visionaries putting in the work to build their dreams. Whether you're shooting a cinematic masterpiece on your phone, filling notebooks with sketches, or up all night turning your bedroom into the booth. Thirst is everything. Obey your thirst. Sprite.
My name is Rachel Monroe, and I am a journalist based in Texas. I write a lot about crime, among many other things. I've been following this particular case for a while, and it's going to be part of a book that I'm writing that's coming out in August called Savage Appetite.
Very cool. Now, how does a journalist in Texas find out about a girl from Illinois coming to Halifax to commit a mass shooting? How did you learn about this?
Well, I had been interested in and following the subculture of Columbiners. I first wrote about them actually in 2012, so 7 years ago, and had been interested in them as an internet phenomenon for a while. And then when I heard that some Columbiners had actually planned a shooting, it really caught my eye, because I had... We can talk about, you know, my take on Columbiners, but one of the things I had thought for a long time is, you know, people who talk online, but what they talk about online is very different from what they do in real life. And so it really made me sit up and pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Your prior work, like before all this happened with Lindsay, with like your work with Columbiners, how did that start? How did you get in? Like, is there any reason you became interested in that subculture?
Well, it started when I had been living in Baltimore, and there was a school shooting that happened, as they happen in the States fairly regularly. It wasn't a big, splashy one, and we have so many school shootings in the U.S. now that there are these local ones that never make the big news, and so this one happened a few miles away from me, and I just went online to get more information about it, and there wasn't a whole lot, but I did find all these Tumblr search results started popping up, and that surprised me. I was like, okay, why is this breaking news trending on Tumblr? And then I saw one of the people on Tumblr mention something about like the Columbiner community. You know, I hope this doesn't reflect badly on the Columbiner community. Or something. Mm-hmm. Like, what is the Columbiner community? And so it was just one of those things that happen sometime. I think a lot of us do this and stumble on something weird on the internet. And then the next thing I know, it was like 3 a.m. and I've just been like scrolling for hours, wow. You know, looking at this weird world that was out there that I had no idea about, and just finding it really strange and fascinating and troubling and interesting, yeah. All at once.
It's kind of like the same way I found out about it, because for me it was, you know, a planned shooting at my mall, at the mall. I started researching it, and that's when I learned of the Columbiner community. So I kind of had the same experience as you, and I remember when I stumbled upon it, it just seemed like one of those things that are almost too strange to be true. Like, I couldn't imagine this existing, but, you know, and then as you dig in and you see, you know, the subculture for what it is, it's very real, and, you know, and it's not, you know, 10 random people. It's a massive group of people.
Yeah, definitely. And the more that I started researching it, so I found there's an academic who I think is French who wrote about how Columbine came to exist online. People who wrote about Columbine online in the years after it happened. And according to her, the original Columbiner community, although I don't think they were calling themselves Columbiners at that point, but there were people on YouTube. This is maybe like 2007, 2008, 2009. And this was like, it tended to be a lot of young men who identified with the Columbine shooters and made videos of themselves, you know, striking similar poses. We know that the Columbine shooters were really into videotaping themselves. So these were almost like tribute videos done in the same style. And then eventually there were a bunch of copycat shootings, school shootings, other mass shootings in the United States by people who were involved in this fandom, young men who were involved in this fandom. So YouTube started cracking down on Columbine content. And according to this researcher, by 2011, it was pretty much gone. There was nothing. If you were posting anything sympathetic about Columbine, it would get taken down really quickly. And so the community that had popped up there vanished. But what I found was that around 2012, when I started looking into it, it had kind of reemerged on Tumblr and became a Tumblr phenomenon. And the interesting thing that was happening there was that instead of being primarily, angry young men, it was a lot of like lovesick young women. And that was what really surprised me.
So they just, once they got kicked off of YouTube, so to speak, they kind of were reborn on, I guess, Tumblr, which is, I didn't know anything about Tumblr either until Lindsay's story. So I feel this story makes me feel very old.
Yeah, I mean, Tumblr is, as far as I can tell, I think it's the social media, one of the social media networks that tends to skew quite female. I think they all skew a little bit female, but this one more than most. It's also just the way that it's set up. It tends to be really popular with fandoms. And so fandoms for, you know, Harry Potter or One Direction or whatever. And so YouTube is sort of more suited to like manifestos, right? Because it's kind of one person with a video. But Tumblr is this very community oriented. There are a lot of in jokes. People are always like reblogging memes that other people made. It's like very heavy on the meme making, which, as you know, Lindsay was really into and kind of talented at in a, you know, disturbing way. And the other thing that happened in 2012 that kind of influenced this community that I found was that, did you ever watch the TV show American Horror Story?
I saw like a season of it.
Okay. Yeah. So the first season, there's a character that like that cute guy and the storyline is directly referencing Columbine. That young man is sort of more, it's like he's a slightly ambivalent heartthrob, but he's like the heartthrob of that season. And so a lot of people have this theory that the Columbine fandom on YouTube and the fact that it was like all these girls with crushes on the Columbine shooters came out because these girls were watching this TV show. They're like, oh, look at that cute boy. They start researching the show, it leads them to Columbine, and then they're like, oh, I have a crush on these real school shooters.
Oh, wow. I don't remember that storyline of the show. What could you just explain that character and how he relates to Columbine?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty convoluted, and I guess these are going to be spoilers if anybody hasn't seen this show that came out, like, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. He's just, like, kind of this moody dreamboat guy who hangs around this haunted house and makes eyes at the teenage daughter, the high school age daughter. And then come to find out that actually he's a ghost, and he's a ghost because he had been depressed and bullied at school, and he bought a gun to his school and shot a bunch of his classmates, in the library. You know, that's like that. They're hiding under tables. I mean, it's directly referencing Columbine. There's a scene in the show that's very clear. And then he ends up being killed by the police. He's a ghost, but he's like a cute ghost. He's also like a rapist. He's like a rapist Columbine heartthrob ghost. It's a very complicated show.
Yeah. Well, just, what's really strange is I made it no secret that the conversations that I had with Lindsay in those original episodes that were heavily edited. It's what you hear in the episodes is probably an hour and a half of probably 4 hours of conversation. But one of the things that I edited out was she was talking about what she's been doing in prison. And she had talked in the episodes, people heard her describe a book she wrote called Grit and Glory that really mirrored her and James's story. But another thing she told me about that didn't make it to the episodes is she's working on a book. She called it Haunt Me Harder. And it was about, if my memory serves me, it's about a young girl who has recently moved into a house, and the house was haunted by a school shooter. And it sounds very, very similar to what you're describing. And that's just, I don't know if it means anything, but that's just kind of interesting. With you following the Columbiner subculture this closely, have you seen many other cases of people actually, you know, attempting or performing a mass shooting that were clearly inspired by or were members of the Columbiner subculture? Like, have you seen other members of this group commit related crimes?
No. Well, and I guess what I should say is there have been a lot of school shooters, people who commit mass violence. Every single one I can think of besides Lindsay is a young man. So I'll say he. There have been many of them who have been interested in Columbine, who have posted on message boards or on YouTube, or have been shown to have researched or otherwise been fascinated with Columbine. So there's definitely a link. I think there's something of like several dozen school shooters since 1999 when Columbine happened have said that they were inspired by Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. So there's certainly a link there. But the Columbiners that I was interested in, they were almost all girls, and they were almost all, you know, like under 18, like girls, some of them quite young. They were up to something more complicated, it seemed to me. I mean, obviously, it's really disturbing when somebody, when a teenage girl says that she has a crush on somebody who's famous for murder. I mean, that's just on the surface really awful and troubling. And it would be really easy to dismiss them as being wannabe mass murderers themselves, or being crazy, or just seeking attention. But I don't know. I thought that there was, like, for me, I ended up thinking of a lot of what I saw back in 2012 as being a way that girls who were suffering from depression or bullying, girls who were angry but didn't quite know how to say it, instead of saying, "I'm really sad" or "I'm really angry," they would say, "I have a crush on this boy who's like famously sad or famously angry." I mean, this is like a classic thing that girls do when they're teenagers. You kind of can't own your own desires or something. So instead of being like, "I want to play guitar," you have a crush on a boy who plays guitar, right? And so I kind of saw this just as a dark version of that. It doesn't make it any less troubling, but it makes it a little bit more understandable in a funny way.
Mm-hmm. Do you see any, like, this sort of thing, do you see any positives coming out of a group like a subculture like the Columbiners? Like, does it give to these people who are hurting and kind of loners, does it give them something positive in the end, or is it all bad, in your opinion?
I don't think that it is all bad. I mean, it's tricky, right? At the time, and back in 2012, I wrote about them a little bit, and I said, you know, these are girls who are finding a community to talk about their pain, to talk about their depression, to talk about, you know, their dark thoughts. They are often like really supportive of each other. They would post things about a hard day they had at school or bullying, and other members of this community would validate them or tell them that they were beautiful or just be kind to them. And so in that way, it did seem like there was some positive that came out of it. But then over time, as I kept kind of checking back in, I saw more and more things that I found really troubling. I mean, there would be, you know, every time that somebody, there was like a new mass shooting, a little fandom would pop up. And I remember being really disgusted when Dylan Roof, who shot the people in the church in Charleston, he immediately, if you go on Tumblr, he immediately had a fandom, you know, of these girls saying like, "I don't care that he was terrible and racist and a white supremacist. You know, he just needs love. He just needs my love." So these girls were saying, you know, "I'm not a racist, but I just love this murderer who is." And I don't know. I stopped, my kind of initial rosy take on it started to diminish a little bit, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. And do you see a subculture like specifically the Columbiners, do you think that it has the potential to be almost like a breeding ground for these types of events? Like, I'm just thinking, if there's a group of young women primarily who are, you know, idolizing people who commit mass shootings, does it seem like it would have the potential to encourage lonely young men to do things to appeal to this group? Do you know what I mean? Like, do you see this as encouraging?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, you see that a little bit with what Lindsay and James did, right? Like, they, a lot of, and I've read their chat transcripts too. And a lot of what they did was thinking about how what they would do would be perceived by the Columbiners, how it would be reposted, how everybody would look at their pictures, how everybody would want to read Lindsay's novel. And so, I mean, that's certainly an instance of some motivation right there.
Yeah, they made it clear that the plan that they had was more about how it would be perceived by fellow Columbiners than how it would be perceived by the members of the public that would, you know, be reacting to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think they also, there's some places in there where they're talking about being international news or, you know, is Lana Del Rey going to write a song about us? Mm. But yeah, I mean, it's tricky, right? This is something that we're dealing with on the internet all the time. How do you preserve space for people to express alternative ideas that maybe we find uncomfortable or objectionable, but that, you know, can deserve to live in the public sphere? And then how do you kind of shut down speech that crosses the line? Where is that line? And I don't know if we figured out a good way yet. Tumblr last August did make a statement that they were going to be cracking down on content that explicitly glorified mass shooters. And, you know, I've never been a person who's like that into censorship. But I have to say, I was kind of like, I sort of think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I think when I hear of like censorship in that level, I think it's a good idea for Tumblr, but it's also like the whole whack-a-mole thing. It's, you know, if that's no longer on Tumblr, there's just going to be some other venue for it. So I think it's an individual company shutting down or blocking this type of content, I think it's more so to protect that company than it is to shut down that language and that, you know, content from existing. I think that
the
internet is just, you know, it's so big, and it turns our small little towns and our bedrooms into these massive metropolises where, you know, there's anybody into any random thing. So, you know, the Columbiner subculture could never, in my mind anyway, could never exist without the internet, because these people from across the world need to be brought together, much like another subculture that is very unique, is like, you know, like the furry movement or whatever, like the people, people, like without the internet, how would these people realize that they all like dressing up as animals and acting like animals together? You know, it's a completely different thing than the Columbiner thing, but it's just like, I don't think there's a way, when you bring a bunch of people together, I think they're going to find each other.
I mean, I guess the maybe the counter argument to that is that when you look at something like the Columbiner community, there are some people in that fandom or whatever who maybe will get there no matter what. But I think then there are some other people who get kind of roped in just kind of on a whim, or because like something catches their eye, or, and then the next thing you know, they're like kind of deeply into this thing. And if you minimize their chance, to stumble on, you know, this internet world where people think murder is great, then maybe they'll find a different way to channel their anger or to talk about their, the problems in their life.
Yeah, and that's a good point, especially in looking at this through the lens of Lindsay's story, because her obsession, I guess, with Columbine only lasted her a couple of months. And she described it in my interview where she was looking for Columbine information while researching her book. And then she ended up just getting sucked into this other world, which kind of led to 2 or 3 months of obsession with Columbine, ending with her getting on a plane to go to Nova Scotia to commit a mass shooting. So I guess, yeah, like if that content hadn't existed on Tumblr and was instead through some weird backdoor on the internet that was hard to access, maybe a vulnerable, sensitive person, you know, wouldn't have found it.
Right. And she had the troubles. She would have had all the troubles in her life anyway, but maybe they wouldn't have taken its expression. And it is just alarming how an obsession that's so brief can really change so much.
The prior work you did and the writing you did about Columbiners and that subculture, does that still exist somewhere? Like, is there somewhere that people who want to learn about this more can read what you've done?
Yeah, I wrote an essay called Killer Crush on a website called The Awl, A-W-L, The Awl. And that was about my initial discovery of the subculture and some of my thoughts about it and how the surprising ways in which I related to some of these girls, even though they also really creeped me out.
And you mentioned you're writing a book that will include Lindsay's story in, I believe, a pretty major way, although the book's still a little ways out. What do you got to say about the book at this point?
Sure. So the book comes out in August 20th, and it's called Savage Appetites. I've been calling it a meta true crime book. It's about the obsession with true crime, particularly women's obsession with true crime. It's always been really interesting to me how, I guess your podcast is an exception, but so much of the content out there is about crime is made by women or has an audience that's primarily female, which is surprising, right? Because most murderers are men, and actually most murder victims are also men. So violent crime is sort of a male world, but then reading about, consuming stories about violent crime is a very female obsession. And so I looked at four different women over the course of the past 100 years who each became fascinated with a crime that didn't happen to her. And so the most recent one is Lindsay. And they each became obsessed kind of with a different figure in the crime story. So there's a woman who became obsessed with detectives, and somebody else who became obsessed with victims, somebody else who became kind of a defender, took on the defender role, getting somebody out of prison, and then Lindsay, who obviously became obsessed with some killers.
Where will people be able to get this, or is it too far away to tell?
You can pre-order it right now, actually, believe it or not, on Amazon or in your favorite local independent bookstore. Just look up Savage Appetites. My name's Rachel Monroe.
I want to end this discussion by again restating the fact that neither Rachel nor I believe that all Columbiners are on the path to committing violent acts. However, it's hard to not see a connection between what Lindsay and James plan to do and their obsession with the Columbine shooting. Fortunately, an anonymous tipster made a call to Crime Stoppers and prevented something like Columbine from occurring at the Halifax Shopping Center. In our next episode in this series, we'll continue to examine the concepts associated with the story of Lindsay Suvonarov and the Valentine's Day mass shooting plot. And with that, we'll conclude this episode of Nighttime. A big thank you to Rachel Monroe for taking some time out of her busy schedule to discuss the Columbiners with me. I'll be anxiously awaiting Rachel's book and plan to invite her back to Nighttime after its release to discuss the book in more detail. A huge shout out to the Canadian bands Vox Somnia and Paragon Cause for providing the musical and ambient themes for this episode. You can check out both great bands' music by following the links in this episode's notes. A big thank you to Tyler of the Westside Fairy Tales podcast and Lisa of the Secret Life of Weddings podcast for again playing the parts of Lindsay and James in the reenactments you heard. Now, I'll end this episode with the biggest thanks of all. I want to thank anyone who's listening, as without you all, I'd have no excuse to spend so much of my time on this show. For anyone out there who wants more Nighttime, please check out the Patreon group. For as little as a dollar a month, you can support the creation of the show and access the supporter exclusive feed, which provides ad-free early releases of episodes in addition to prior episodes that are no longer available on the main feed. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And with that said, I'd like to thank the current patrons of the show and welcome the newest members to the group. Tiffany M., Charlie Hutchings, and the Megan Fox. I appreciate your generous support of Nighttime. For anyone else who'd like to support the show but can't help financially, you can give me a big hand by telling your friends about me and leaving a positive review on Apple Podcasts or whichever equivalent you use. If any of you listening want to stay up to date with my activities on and off the show, follow me on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I use the handle @NighttimePod. If you have any story ideas or feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. Now, until next time, take care of each other, hug your loved ones tight, and let me know if you see anything weird.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.
New on Showcase.
They call me the Christchurch Carver.
Based on the international bestseller.
This trademark souvenir.
Can't stop thinking about the apple. Usually he eats it.
I've got a copycat on my hands.
I know who you are, Joe. I know what you do. You have 2 days to find a copycat.
This is way harder to make sense of when you didn't do it.
Dark City, The Cleaner. All new Wednesdays on Showcase. Stream on Stack TV.